This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publicize your book. And there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in Anthropology, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Reagan Gillum, a host on the channel, and today I'm talking to Dr. Paul Stoller, who is the author of the book Wisdom from the Edge, Writing Ethnography in Turbulent Times, published by Cornell University Press. Dr. Stoller, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Reagan. It's wonderful to be here.
Yeah, I'm really excited to talk with you about your book today. And I have an introductory question. And to begin with, you've written 11 books, as well as many articles and public writing. You focused your fieldwork over a very long period of time with the Songhai people in Niger. So how did you come to research Niger? And, you know, how did you come to write Wisdom from the Edge?
Well, my story goes back a long time, because I first went to the Republic of Niger many, many decades ago as a Peace Corps volunteer. And I lived there for 2 years in the Songhai-speaking area of Western Niger. And in that two-year period, I taught English as a second language, but I fell profoundly in love with the people and the culture there, and I learned to speak the Songhai language fluently. And so once my two-year stint was up, I tried to find ways, how could I get back to Niger? And I decided that I would go back. I would go to graduate school, and I first studied linguistics, and then from my linguistics background, I went on into social anthropology, and I was able to get a research grant to do my doctoral research in the western part of Niger, in some of the same towns where I had been a Peace Corps volunteer, actually.
And so how did you come to write Wisdom from the Edge?
Well, Wisdom from the Edge is the culmination. Actually, it's my 16th book. And, excuse me. And it's sort of the culmination of my apprenticeship to healers among Songhai people in Western Niger. So, and as I thought back to all the period of time that I was doing my research, I was profoundly linked to one particular person, my teacher, Ademujeni Tongo, who lived to be 106 years old, who was a great Sohanchi, which is Sohanchis are healers that trace their descent all the way back to Sunni Ali Bair, the king of the Songhai Empire in the 15th century. A direct line. So he was a direct descendant of Sunni Ali Bair. And he was one of the wisest people that I ever met in my life. And reflecting back on everything that I learned from him, all of my work really is, in a sense, an attempt to bring his wisdom to a larger audience. And so Wisdom from the Edge is really a compilation of my thinking and reading and doing anthropology over the last 35, 40 years. And I hope that it is a tribute to his wisdom and what he has to teach us about living in the world today.
Yeah, thank you so much for that. I really enjoyed reading the book. And I really enjoyed reading all of the different, you know, the different chapters and about your mentor, Adamo Jenny Tangu. And so I wanted to ask about the introduction of the book. You write about this representational dilemma whereby, you know, anthropological texts follow this expected formula and they can create what you call turgid texts of limited appeal. And so you advocate for artful ethnography in the book. And this is where writers sensuously articulate dimensions of locality, language, and character. Again, I'm quoting you. And so I wondered if you could talk about what you mean by artful ethnography.
Well, first of all, a lot of anthropology is, I hate to say it, but it's badly written. You don't find... one of my quandaries is that anthropologists have an awful lot to say about conditions in the world today, ecological conditions, social conditions, political situations, and yet our message, and it's based on slowly gathered fieldwork over many, many years of study and thought, but our message more or less falls on deaf ears, and that one of the reasons for that is that it's written with lots of jargon. It's written for an audience of fellow specialists, and therefore the message that we have, which is an important message today about our relation to nature, our relation to one another, gets lost in the fog of institutional expectation. A lot of what I've done during my time as an anthropologist has been trying to forefront narrative as a way of bringing people and place to a much larger audience than just a group of fellow specialists. So I've tried to do that in my writing. And more recently, I have developed over the last 15 years, I've been giving writing workshops, ethnographic writing workshops, mostly in Europe, but some in the United States, one workshop in Ghana. And there I get usually postgraduate students, PhD students, recent PhD students. And we learn we do exercises to sort of unlock the creativity of artful ethnography. And artful ethnography, what it really is using the senses to recreate the space of ethnography. So evoking the space and place where of the people about whom we try to write, crafting dialogue, and constructing character. So these are all techniques used by fiction writers and techniques used by creative nonfiction writers. And so in that first chapter, I have a number of examples of how fiction writers and creative nonfiction writers, and several anthropologists as well, how they evoke space, how they craft dialogue, and how they construct character as sort of models for ethnographic writing. And so artful ethnography is an ethnography that, focuses on narrative, focuses on character, space and place, focuses on how people talk, such that when someone finishes reading a book that incorporates those elements, they will know, they'll have a sense of who these people are or what they're like, what their lives are like, the texture of their social lives, but they will also have a sense, you know, they'll have a sense of the humanity of these people and what they have to teach us about living in the world. And so all of that is sort of a call for a more sort of artistically engaged ethnographic writing in which these elements are used, and which means that the scope, the breadth of the audience that we might attract would be expanded considerably, such that our insights, our anthropological insights, might be better distributed, better known, and better appreciated by the public.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you so much for that. And so, speaking of character, in chapter one, you talk about the quality of the narrative can be related to the thickness of the relationships the anthropologist has with mm-hmm. other people. And one of the things you write about is that many texts are missing vulnerable characters. And these are imperfect human beings whose life stories compel readers or audiences to connect. And I found this really interesting because I'm currently working on a book right now. And I thought about this and I thought, who are my vulnerable characters? How do I know, how do I know that they exist? How can I put them in there? And so, this was really compelling to me. And I wondered if you could talk about these vulnerable characters and what they bring to an ethnographic text.
Well, what vulnerability does, if one writes, about vulnerable characters, one can also include oneself in that exercise. If one sort of opens oneself up to vulnerability, what it does is it creates a connection between the reader and the writer. So when a character is vulnerable, they're human, they have strengths, and of course they have weaknesses. That's all part of making them the character of who they might be. And so what that does is it creates this, this fundamental connection. And when you create that kind of fundamental connection between a character on the page or the writer connects with the reader or the filmmaker connects with the audience, what that does is it, in my experience, it compels the reader to turn the page, which is the great goal of any writing, especially in this age of distraction in which we live. It compels the viewer, if they're watching a film, to continue to identify with the character, care about the character, and continue to watch the film. And so vulnerability is, it's a really very essential aspect of character presentation. And if you are able to pull it off, you will have people, reading your text and continuing to read it and recommending it maybe to someone else or watching your film. One of the delights of the films of Jean Rouch, my mentor in Niger and in France, was that his characters, they were flawed. They had multiple elements to them. They were funny. They were sad. There's betrayal. All elements of the human condition and what makes us human beings. And so if you have that sense of vulnerability in your characterizations of in your text, then it draws readers into the text and makes them think about it. Maybe it makes them think something they might have not thought before. Maybe it makes them feel something they haven't felt before. And if you're doing that, then you're doing your job as a writer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. That's a lesson that I'm going to take with me as I continue to write this book.
Well, good. I wish you every success.
Thank you. And so you already mentioned this, your mentor, Adamu Jenny Tangu in Niger, figures quite prominently throughout the book. And, you write that over these 17 years, Adamu Jenny Tangu guided me to the portal of an incomprehensible world. And so I really like the stories that you share with your mentor. So there was one, I think, where he gave you some mixture to throw over your shoulder in an airplane. And you said, how do I do this? And he said, well, you just have to find a way, Paul. And you found the way. And, And you share these stories of these experiences in his compound. How did he come to take you on as an apprentice? And what do you think contributed to the transformative nature of this relationship?
Well, when I first went to Niger, I taught English as a second language in a town called Tillabéri, which is where Adamu Jenitongo lived. And the secondary school was at the base of a dune. And I lived in a concrete bungalow with the other faculty members there. And, and I would frequently while I was, at the late afternoons when I was just finished teaching, I'd hear music coming from the top of the dune. And I didn't pay much attention to it at first, but after a while, curiosity got the better of me. And so I trudged up to the dune and to what turned out to be his compound. And there was a ceremony going on. I knew what it was. It was a spirit possession ceremony going on. So there are people in there dancing, and there I heard the cry of the one string violin, a high pitched sort of whine, and then there were gourd drums being played. So you have the clack, whine, clack, and so this old man came up to the entrance of his compound, and he said, "Please come in, please come and see our ceremony." So I walked in there, and he was standing next to me, and I was on the edge of the audience, and the music was playing. And the music was extraordinarily rhythmic. I like to dance. So I started moving my body, And then Adamu Jenitongo said, "Well, why don't you try it? Watch them. And why don't you try dancing?" So I went, I was 23 years old. I had no worries whatsoever. So I went out to the dance. I went out to the dance ground, and the musicians picked up the pace. And I started dancing, doing as best I could, to mimic the dancers that I had been witnessing. And then everyone thought that was really nice, and they sort of applauded a little bit. And he took me aside and he said, "You have shown us respect for our customs. We want, I want you to come back. I want you to come back and be a witness to our rituals. Be a witness to these spirit possession ceremonies." And so whenever there was a spirit possession, so when I heard the music, I would go up and I befriended him and his family and all the people who were up there. And I saw lots of spirit possession, lots of people getting, mediums getting taken by spirits. I began to recognize some of the music. And that was my, that was my introduction to him. But then my time in Tillabéri as a Peace Corps volunteer was coming to an end, but that experience sort of was a compelling factor to make me want to go to graduate school and come back to study this kind of thing. So I did my initial fieldwork not in Tillabéri, but in another place called Mehana, which is on the opposite bank of the Niger River, on the west bank of the Niger River. And I was looking at spirit, I was looking at the competing discourses of Islam and spirit possession in the local politics of this particular town. And so I would witness spirit possession ceremonies. And then one day, I'd do my interviews. I'd talk to people. It was too hot to do much in the afternoon. So I'd go into my mud brick house, and I had a Smith Corona typewriter. And I would type up my field notes, and people would come into my house just to watch me type, just they thought that was kind of a cool thing to do. So I always had an audience while I was typing up my field notes. I noticed after a while that there are these birds that had built a mud nest in the rafters of my ceiling, which was made of sticks and mud. And they began to poop all over my floor. And my being sort of antiseptic American, I felt this was intolerable. So I knocked down the nests and they flew off. And then 2 weeks later, they'd build another nest, and they stayed in the house. After a while, I forgot. I just said, "The hell with it. I'm not going to bother messing with these birds." And I just forgot about them. And then one day, while I was typing up my field notes, describing a spirit possession ceremony that I had recently seen, one of the birds pooped on my head, right? And so I said, I lost it. I said, I can't stand this. I can't stand this place. This place is just, I knock the nest down, they come back. I knock it down, they come back. Now they pooped on my head. What? And then one of the guys said, Alhamdulillah, he said, praise be to God. I said, well, what? Praise be to God. I said, well, how can you say that? He said, you've been pointed out. And I said, well, you know, no, of course I've been pointed out. And he said, no, no, no. Come to my house tonight and begin to learn incantations. I am a surko, which is a kind of healer. And so I went to his house and, you know, I decided, well, that wasn't my dissertation project, but it was such an opportunity. I decided I would take it. So I crossed the threshold and I, you know, I had plenty of notes on my dissertation topic, but then I went to his house and he began to teach me. I started to memorize incantations. After about a 3 or 4 month period, I'd learned lots of incantations. His father initiated me and had me eat some weird stuff, tree barks and mixed with millet grains, that would transform me to an apprentice, right? And then they said, you know, well, you know, we can't really teach you much more. You have to go to our teacher. And I said, well, who is that? And he said, well, he lives in Tillabéri. You know who he is. And I said, you mean Adamu Jeni Tongo? And he said, yeah, he's our teacher. You have to learn from him. So I, you know, I left Mehana, the town where I was. I went to back to Tillabéri, and I clapped in front of his house. He came, gave me a big smile, and it had been 4 or 5 years since I had seen him. And he gave me a big smile and said, "What took you so long?" Right, and then that was the beginning of our apprentice, our master, mentor-mentee relationship, master-apprentice relationship. So I lived in his compound whenever I was in Niger. I watched what he did. I watched him treat clients. I watched him officiate spirit possession ceremonies. He taught me to go into the bush to look for plants. I learned quite a bit from him in that 17-year period. And that's how I got into this kind of stuff. And then, you know, and I learned so much from him, then after he died, I didn't go back as often as much. It was a very, you know, very painful loss for me. And so I started doing field work in New York City, because I found it too painful to go back to Niger. And there was other circumstances that involved as well that made it less desirable to return to my field site.
So you also talk about Jean Roush in the book, and he was a filmmaker who you just mentioned. You've also written a book about him called Cinematic Griot. But in this book, Wisdom from the Edge, you describe his approach to the world. And you offer these 5 rules to approach life garnered from Roush's outlook and practices. And I'm not going to go through all the rules, but the first rule is to fully engage in the moment. And you talk about rule number 4, which is to open yourself to the world and accept vulnerability, which you've already talked about a little bit. And so I wondered just how these rules, you know, how they shape, you know, approaches to anthropology.
Well, I think, I mean, field work, anthropological field work is a purely subjective experience. And very often it is existentially transformative. It's filled with stress and strain. It's very difficult to, you know, sometimes it's difficult to stay focused on what you're doing. But also, I think one of the key lessons that Roush taught me about fieldwork is to be flexible. In other words, if say you have a proposal and you have a study that you've been granted funding for it, and you're making some progress on that, but then something else happens that piques your interest and you find it absolutely fascinating. Someone's inviting you, like the Sorko who said, the bird pooped on your head. You know, what should I do? Should I continue with my dissertation proposal? I'm sorry, dissertation research, or should I just step into this other world? And in filmmaking, they have the same kind of thing where you may be thinking you're going to do a film about X, Y, or Z, and then something happens. A character pops up who is, you know, cinematic and very fascinating, and you take your, you know, the key is you don't stick with your program. You follow the person who's of cinematic interest, right? So, and Ruch was, the way he did films was that way. He was very, he is very sort of innovative. So the film would have sort of make itself as time went on. It was, you know, sort of an interesting system of innovation. That's how he made Le Maître Fou. It's how he made Jaguar, two of his most fantastic films. They were, you know, sort of lots of innovation involved, lots of, character input to say, let's try this, or why not try that? So that kind of, you know, so you need to be focused, obviously, on what you're doing, but you also need to be kind of sort of epistemologically flexible to know when to, you know, say, okay, well, that's good, but this, you know, I need to shift and go in this direction because this looks like it's very fruitful. So those kinds of lessons are very important. But I think the most important thing is to come back to vulnerability. And that is that, you know, if you, as a field worker, if you open yourself to the world in which you're trying to understand, open your being to it, people will recognize that, right? I think I may have given the example in the book about the artist Paul Klee, who said that to paint the forest, he had to open his being to it and let the forest penetrate him. And he would paint as a way of, you know, sort of breaking out of that cycle. And I think it's the same thing with ethnographic fieldwork. Is if you open yourself up to the field and let it penetrate you, you're gonna people will recognize that, first of all. They'll recognize that's sort of you're genuine in a sense. You are trustworthy. They will recognize your humanity, your vulnerability. And it creates, as I said before, the connection, the kind of connection. And I also think that, it creates a kind of, as I said, vulnerability. And it's a very, very important kind of thing, but it's risky. So it's not easy to do this sort of thing. It's not easy to say, I'm just going to open myself to the experience of, say, healing and sorcery, right? But if you don't do that, then you may understand a little bit of, say, a phenomenon like healing or sorcery or spirit possession. But if you don't open yourself up to it, people will recognize that. And so what you will get will be maybe a fraction of what you could understand otherwise. And one thing leads to another. As Jean Roussel like to say, you know, one film gives birth to another, or one incident gives birth to another, if and only if you are, you know, you are open, which is signifying that you're existentially vulnerable. And I think that you know, it's not for everyone, but it is, something that really does make a big difference when you're doing anthropological fieldwork.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I liked what you were saying about opening yourself to the world and the kind of risk of it and managing the kind of fraught emotions around fieldwork. I had this one experience where it was kind of years into the field where I was in Brazil and I was interviewing a filmmaker, and he gave me these directions to come to his house where I had to take, this was in Rio de Janeiro, I had to take a bus across town and then take a boat, you know, go to this dock and tell them I'm going to this house and take a boat to here. And I remember, you know, I thought, oh my gosh, you know, and how am I going to do this? And I managed to do it, but I remember just realizing in that moment, okay, it's about the journey and I just have to submit myself to it and kind of, you know, just give in to the moment and to the, you know, to the path. And so that took a while for me to actually get there, but I think it reflects what you were talking about, you know,
well,
just letting go a little
bit. It's one of my favorite quips. Yeah.
So I really appreciated your attention to the ineffable qualities of human life. And you write about learning divination from different diviners, but there seems to be like a limit to transfer this knowledge of divination. And some people have the gift and other people don't. And you write about kind of accepting the limits of knowledge and that there are things we simply can't know. And I wondered about, you know, navigating these limits with when people expect us to be the authority figures. And, you know, so how do we navigate this authority that we are expected to have, but also the knowing that there are limits to knowledge?
Well, I think the most important thing that a scholar can say is, I don't know. And when I've told my students, when they ask me a question that I don't know an answer to, and I say, well, I don't know, I have to think about that, or I have to think about that, or I may never have an answer to that. So there's an awful lot, you know. For me, it's an important thing. We cannot know everything, and there's some things in the worlds of sorcery, healing, spirit possession, there are some things that the knowledge is reserved for elders. So if you're a young researcher, you don't have access to that kind of thing. Even if you've made yourself vulnerable, you open yourself up, you're not old enough to receive this particular piece of knowledge. So there are lots of limits to knowledge, but I think when you acknowledge that, it creates a sense of, I think it's important to create a sense of academic modesty that, you know, we cannot have, a theory cannot necessarily solve all of our problems. It suggests also, a more collaborative approach to understanding the world, understanding ethnographic worlds. There's a fabulous book by, Timothy Morton and Dominique Boyer called Hyper Subjects. It's on Becoming Human Again. And basically, it's about the sort of edifice of scholarship of the academic institutions and built on what you were just saying about authoritative knowledge. And, even given that, you know, the... when we reach the limits of what we can understand, it doesn't mean we start not trying to understand why this particular ritual works or why it does not. But to understand that the song I have a wonderful way of dealing with this issue. They say, you know, the people that I train with would say, well, you know, I've learned a lot. But what I know is that I've incorporated everything that my fathers and fathers' fathers, mothers and mothers' mothers have taught, and it's been passed down from generation to generation, and that's what I know. And then that's my I am a custodian of that knowledge, so I want to, and I, you know, I nurture it, I guard it, I make sure that it's not forgotten. And then as an elder, my responsibility is to convey that knowledge to the next generation. That's my greatest responsibility, convey that knowledge to the next generation, knowing that it's not the full picture, knowing that what I convey will be used in the next generation in a way that maybe I can't even imagine, or in a way that suits their own purpose, given the circumstances in which they live. So I feel that about anthropology. I feel like, you know, people have come before me, had a lot to teach me. I've incorporated that knowledge. I've incorporated it and, you know, written about it, et cetera, and that there is my body of work, and so it's there for to be consumed. I'm the custodian of my corpus of work, but. I realize that, you know, people will, you know, if people continue to read what it is about, and again, getting back to the artful ethnography, is that artful ethnographies tend to live on. They don't, they're read by, they have the potential of being read by a larger audience. If you have narratives, there's something about narrative that make people want to talk about it, make people remember things. And so once, you know, the next generation of scholars may look at what I have written and they will say, well, that's an interesting thing, but I can use, that triggers an idea to go in a different direction. And so that's the way that's the way knowledge has been trained in the sort of master apprentice kind of relationship. That's the way knowledge has been transmitted. And that's how it continues to be translated from generation to generation. And each successive step, you know, it gets refined. It gets refined and in a way that is suited to the situation in which people find themselves. Mm-hmm. And so that for Song Eye Healers, and I think for anthropologists as well, is that that's our, you know, our mission is to gather the information, and produce the knowledge, knowing that it's not going to be perfect, that there are limits to it, and then passing it on to the next generation for them, and for the next generation of scholars or healers or whatever, to do with it what they will in the best way that mm-hmm. they can.
Yeah, and so I wanted to go back to this. You just mentioned this artful ethnography, and you've already described it for us. And in the book, you know, you advocate for using smell, taste, sound, touch, and the visual to communicate these sensuous aspects of experience. And you provide these examples from spirit possession ceremonies and your mentor's compound. You talked about this. You give these ethnographic writing workshops about this method of writing. And I wondered if you could give us a glimpse into the workshop and say a little bit about what kind of activities or exercises are you doing, or, you know, what is the workshop like that you're giving people?
Okay. Well, they vary depending on the last one I did was in Germany, in Göttingen, Germany, at the Max Planck Institute. And there we did a 4-day workshop. I've done it online. During the pandemic, I did it online. Sometimes I've done, you know, 4-day workshops. I did, during the pandemic, I did one at the Graduate Institute at the University of Geneva. That was a whole semester. Usually they're 4 to 5 days. And the first thing I do is I give them, a famous, scholar's text, one paragraph of I often use Pierre Bourdieu, right? Is, you know, a great, great thinker, but one of the worst writers mm-hmm. I can think of. You know, it's just terrible writing. It's turgid, it's full of, it's much more complicated than it needs to be. So I pick out I usually use the book Distinction, his sort of magnum opus. And you can turn to any page and find bad writing. And so I have them try to translate a paragraph of Bourdieu such that your mother, father, grandmother, grandfather, daughter, or son could understand it, what he's getting at, right? And so the whole idea of that is we're so trained in graduate school to follow this sort of model of sort of, you know, plain style and using, demonstrating our mastery of the discipline by using jargon, complex sentences, passive voice, all that kind of thing. And so what this does is it presents that by usually a famous anthropologist or sociologist. And I challenge them to try to break it down into a simpler language that is accessible to not just highly trained specialists, but to a sort of, a general lay reader, right? And so that's just the beginning. And so we have fun, people start writing. And then as in most writing workshop type things, people come up with some stuff. We read it to each other. So if I have a group of 15 or so, we go around the table, everyone reads what they have produced. And some people come up with really creative solutions. They do like mini plays. Sometimes they come up with, really, really creative solutions to the problem that Bourdieu is putting out there. And then some people try to stick to the text but make it a little bit less convoluted. But the whole purpose of that is just to shake up, to make people aware of these kind of writerly conventions that are so ingrained into the epistemology of academia, academic representation. So then, we take a break, and then we come back, and we I have reading lists. I have writers that I think they should read to get a sort of model of the three things we work on. We work on space, evoking space and place. We work on crafting dialogue, and we work on the construction of character. And so for, space and place, there's some fabulous anthropological writers, a guy named Piers Vitebsky, who was at Cambridge University, who works in Siberia, and he describes the Siberian landscape with breathtaking detail. I have examples from fiction writers, nonfiction writers. Right here, I can see in my, I have one by Lucas Bashir, which is called Running Out. It's about water in the high plains of Kansas. But he describes landscapes with just absolute breathtaking beauty. So you feel like you're there. So I ask people to pretend that, pick out a landscape from your research, a building, a stream, a tree, and think of that space or place as being something that is alive with memory. And, so it's not just an inert space. It's alive with memory. What memories are in this? What has this tree witnessed? Mm. What has this stream seen? What has this path? What stories does it hold? And so that sort of unlocks the creative aspects of a person's particular field site or space or place. And then people write, we have a writing session, and then we come back and we read, and then we respond to one another. And the reason for reading and responding is that when you do a workshop like this, what you're doing is creating not just exercises, but you're creating a community of writers. And writers often gather together and read what they've written to one another as to get feedback. And, it builds one's confidence, people have, critical comments, but they're done, the way we do it, at least in my workshops, the critical comments are done in a way that is that's very constructive. And so I've been doing this for like 15 years, and they have been, many of the people who've participated in these workshops are now publishing books, which makes me really, really proud and makes me feel good. I'm still in touch with almost everyone that has been in one of my workshops. And, space, the thing about space and places is that one of the things that ethnography is really, one of its important features is that it gives the reader a sense of space and place. It evokes space and place. And if you do that, the reader is going to get a sense of, this is where these people are living, right? These conditions create a set of context constraints for how they live their lives. And if you can reproduce that, that's really fantastic for your text. Then the second element is crafting dialogue, which is the most difficult thing to do because it's really, really hard to reproduce speech on the page and the text. Very, very difficult. So I have them read, Zora Neale Hurston, who is one of the Mules and Men. It's filled with dialogue, fantastic dialogue. I have them read some other people as well, I say, think about a dialogue that you had. Most dialogues in anthropology are, they're transcripts of interviews, right? With a block of text in a book. Well, for me, when I see a long block of text in a book, I tend to, skip over it. I mean, it's just, and it's, there's no, you have no sense of what this person sounds like. You have no sense of, you know, the idiosyncrasies of their speech, which might make them interesting. So I advocate recreating dialogue the way you see it in a work of fiction or creative nonfiction, where people are actually engaging with one another as they're talking to one another. So we do that. And people find that to be the most, I mean, for me, I have the greatest respect for playwrights because they're able to underscore, evoke literary themes just through the use of dialogue, which is, you know, amazingly difficult thing to do, but they're able to do it. So I have, you know, great admiration for that. I myself have had, you know, I find that the most difficult thing when I write is to recreate, you know, to craft dialogue. It's a very difficult thing, but it's good. The more you do it, the better you get at it, you know. So, and I have people read mystery writers, you know. So Walter Mosley is one of, you know, he's a great dialogue writer, just great dialogue writer. There are a number of other mystery writers that were really, really very good at dialogue. So I have people read those kinds of things as models of one way to do it, you know, one way to approach your own dialogue material. And then the third thing is we construct character. You know, what is it about a person that makes them unique? Is it the way they stand? Do they have a facial grim? Do they have a facial expression that they hold? Do they grin a lot? What are their eyes like? What's their posture like? Do they walk in a particular way? Do they repeat a certain phrase again and again and again? You know, and like my teacher, Adam Agenda Hunger, used to say, bup, 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 you know, just as an emphasis. And so what is it about a person that makes them stand out from everyone else? And so how do you do that? And again, I have people read mostly fiction writers and how they craft character. And you know, it may be the way they present themselves, the clothes they're wearing. And very often that character construction corresponds to, you know, the way they talk as well. So all these things, when you put them all together, at the end, we have an exercise where we put all the things they've been working on together into a coherent essay that features, you know, place and space, dialogue and character. And then I tell them, I said, you know, people always raise the issue. Well, you know, I'm working in a university and, you know, this kind of writing is not, you know, it's not going to help me get tenure. You know, I can't get a grant to do this kind of thing. And I say, look, this is just providing you with a toolkit and you can just, you know, you can use it now or pack it away and use it when it's right for you to use it. But you know, remember that, you know, I use the example of going to anthropology meetings, right, which are chaotic events, to say the least, where people read 15-minute papers, right, usually read from the text. And I asked them, I said, how many papers other than your own do you remember listening to and remember after you've left the convention? And I tell them, for me, the ones I remember, and there are very few and far between, one was Margaret Mead, who gave a talk, and she told stories, and she was funny, and she used the stories and humor to get to the point that she was making, and a number of other people are able to do that. So there's something about this sort of narrative approach that involves space and place, dialogue and character, that connects with people. So Jerome Bruner, the late Jerome Bruner, who was a cognitive psychologist, but wrote a lot about two modes of evoking reality. One was a scientific mode, which, you know, plain style and logical kind of reasoning, which is, you know, which has stood, you know, stood the test of time for a long, long time. Then he said that there's the narrative mode of reality. And he said, this is, you know, and he said that what people remember, the way culture is conveyed, the way knowledge is passed from generation to generation is through stories. There's something about a story that makes, and he doesn't really know what it is, but there's something about a story that makes you remember it. something about it that makes you remember it, right? Mm-hmm. And then, and you may tell it to someone else, right? It may be slightly, so there's something about that, you know, the narrative construction of reality, he called it. There's something about that that is very human. And so I guess, you know, one of the things that I try to advocate is to make our ethnographies, as anthropologists, make our ethnographies more narrative-like, so that people, when they read what you've written in this narrative, they say, well, that was a good story. And, you know, maybe they'll remember it, right? Maybe they will find it useful. Maybe they'll tell the story to their kids or their colleagues. And then all the stories, of course, have a kind of embedded theoretical point, right? And so Carol McGranahan has written beautifully about the poignancy of storytelling in anthropology. And she says it's not just, you know, the story is the point of doing anthropology, she says. And I quite agree with her. You know,
that, oh, absolutely. Those workshops sound wonderful, where whenever I teach ethnographic research methods, after the students have spent the entire semester doing these different exercises, at the end, we have a writing workshop and they get to write up some of their, you know, some of their observations, and that they really love it. And it's almost like the treat at the end of the semester. And I love what you were saying about creating community, because a lot of people either say they don't like writing, or, you know, we know that writing can sometimes be painful, but it sounds like in these workshops, you know, the load may be a little bit lighter in, you know, going at it together.
We actually have fun. we laugh and we take breaks for lunch. We go to dinner after the sessions, and you know, we have every time I've done it, there's been this sort of sense of community that's generated, and people have said, you know, they may not apply what they've learned immediately, but eventually they do, in my experience at least. And so I think that, you know, that's one thing about writers in general. So a lot of writers, you know, have writing groups where they share things, and that kind of camaraderie, because writing is a struggle. I mean, it's a struggle. It's not easy to do. And it's kind of lonely. It's isolated. You're standing in front of your screen, or sitting in front of your screen typing away. Maybe you're stuck. Maybe you've reached a fantastic passage. But no one writes anything, books, for example. No book is written alone. You need, I've always had people help me, collaborate with me, read what I've written, save me from myself. And, you know, so books are always a collaborative effort. And writers understand that. And therefore, writing workshops, especially, you know, in the sort of more academic settings where people, maybe not used to that kind of collaboration, are really, I think, a very important thing to do, and you know, and to sort of institute in graduate education for anthropology. So there's not a whole lot of ethnographic writing courses in undergraduate or graduate anthropology. And I think we need more of those, quite frankly.
Yeah. So I have one more question, and it is about writing. And because you do a considerable amount of public writing as well, and in the book, even you mentioned blogging, and you've also written a book about your public writing. And, you know, I think this is so, you know, important now, as, and you talk about anthropologists need to get our insights out into the world. I wondered how you made your way into public writing. And does your writing shift at all when you're writing for the public versus writing an anthropological book?
Okay, that's a great question. Around 2010, I had, you know, published a bunch of books, I did a bunch of articles, and I was getting frustrated because no one seemed to be reading what I was writing, and I put all this effort into writing these articles for this journal or that journal or several books. And, you know, and I would go to meetings and I say, you know, people would say, well, I saw your article in such and such a journal. I said, well, thank you. You know, and I said, did you read it? He said, well, no, I saw it, but I haven't read it. right? And so, you know, in years past, people would have these long, you know, kind of long sort of debates and conversations about these kinds of things. And today's distracted world is less of that. So I got kind of, I got frustrated. And then I have a dear friend. She suggested that I try blogging. And so the first thing I did was I blogged. I was taking a trip to Niger, and I went. I hadn't been there in a long time, and I did a blog as sort of like a chronicle of my trip. And I had a private blog, you know, WordPress blog. And no one seemed to be reading that. And I'd get maybe two or three people, maybe 10 people responding to my blog posts. And I get lots and lots of spam. I mean, tons of spam. And so my friend, who's a wonderful writer herself, Gina Ulisse, who had been writing for the Huffington Post, said, well, why don't you try blogging for them? So I did a pitch, and they accepted it. And then I blogged for them for about 10 years or so, or eight to 10 years, on all kinds of things, on politics, on higher education, on well-being, West Africa, also African politics. And, you know, and I was amazed that that on some of the blogs I did, I would get, you know, huge responses of, you know, 3,000 reposts, you know, and maybe 80 to 90,000 people reading what I was writing. And very often what I would, you know, when I did a lot during the election of 2012, when Obama was running. And I did a lot on, you know, the Trump years, up to a point. And I was using anthropological concepts and reaching, you know, so in one case for like the debt ceiling, which is going to be a problem in the coming weeks, I used to analyze the sort of stalemate. I used Gregory Bateson's notion of schismogenesis, to, mm-hmm. you know, which fit perfectly this scenario. So I was doing those kinds of things. And then I, you know, the things changed at the Huffington Post, and I now blog periodically for Psychology Today on well-being. And blogging is, you reach more people. But you have to be very economical in what you do. Most blogs are 850 to 1,000 words, which is not a whole lot of words, and so you have to be really very precise, and you can't really so you may expand your audience, but you give up nuance, academic nuance, let's say. So that's not a good thing. So there are pros and cons. But I found that because of having blogged for so long, I feel that it has improved my prose. It's made it more precise, more focused than it was before. So for me, it's been a great exercise in doing that. And so you have to give up jargon. You have to be very, very, write short sentences and realize that your audience is a general audience rather than an academic one. And so you need to, you know, use narrative also in a blog. I wrote one blog about poverty in America, but I used it as riding a Greyhound bus from Atlanta, Georgia to, Asheville, North Carolina. And I was, you know, this middle-class white guy on the bus, and it was filled with immigrants, poor people, people who didn't have a whole lot of money, and there was me. And so this was a vision of America that was, you know, for me, it was hidden in a sense, but there it was right there in front of us, you know, and it's there every day on the bus. And so I use the ride to talk about how we close our eyes to poverty. So it was a mini sort of ethnography of a bus ride, but it enabled me to talk anthropologically about the problems of poverty in the United States. So I think it's, you know, I think it's a great thing for people to do that. And ultimately it improves one's writing. Often in my writing workshops, I have one half a day that we devote or a day to doing a blog. So we can, you know, I say, you know, use your ethnographic experience to write about some kind of public policy debate or a political issue. And, you know, some of the results are, you know, some people have published stuff based on that exercise. So it's been a, you know, I'm very, very glad that I've done that. And I think that we need to be more, in these times, we need to be more public than we've been in the past, and to reward public engagement as well, institutionally.
So thank you so much for talking with us about your book. You've been a prolific writer of books. You said 16 books earlier. I said 11, so I was incorrect. 16 books, other articles and public work. I saw an exhibition that you did at Westchester University about your work there. And so my last question is, after Wisdom from the Edge, what are you planning next?
Well, I'm working on a book about, it's tentatively called Healing Stories. And I'm interested in what makes a person a healer. How do they come to a life of healing, whether they're a physician or a healer like my teacher, Adama Jenny Tongo. What is it about a person that enables them to learn this kind of thing and also bear the burden of doing it? So I've got a book idea. Well, in this book, I'm going to try to juxtapose images of healers and healing to text, the way that sort of Ruth Behar does in An Island Called Home, and the way that Philippe Bourgois does in Righteous Dope Fiend, and some other people, where there's going to be sort of like a conversation between the image and the text. And I have, you know, I'm going to talk about a wide variety of healers, some who are physicians, some who are non-physician healers, but also I'm going to talk about healing narratives, and I'm going to hopefully write about healing spaces. There are places that people go to be healed, by, you know, like a healing well, for example, in Ireland, or healing wells. So it's, you know, it's just, I'm right at the beginning of this. I'm just sort of jotting out but I'll be working on this in the next year, year and a half, until I, you know, I should maybe finish it sometime in 2025. I'm also interested in doing a podcast on two kinds of things in my podcast that I want to do once I get everything together. One would be to, you know, have a podcast on writing social life, where I invite writers, you know, creative nonfiction writers and ethnographers to talk about their writing practices in a podcast. But I also want to talk, have a podcast on healing as well. So invite healers to talk about their practices and how they came to be healers. So those are things that I'm thinking about doing in the future.
Wow. Well, so we will definitely look out for that, for the book on healing, yeah, and then for these future podcasts. And then we hope that I can have you back on this podcast to talk about the new book as well. So
that would be a great pleasure.
Yes, we will look out for that. So thank you so much for sharing about this book and your work. I'm Reagan Gillum. I've been speaking with Dr. Paul Stoller, who's the author of the book Wisdom from the Edge, Writing Ethnography in Turbulent Times, published by Cornell University Press. Thank you so much for writing this book and for sharing it with us on the podcast.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to talk with you.